Well, this is the Gratitude to Parents Day. This is, as Chandi reminded me, 18th year. It only seems a couple of years ago that he suggested this. But it's... it's very important reflection, living in a modern society where we tend to take things for granted and demand rights and privileges. And sometimes there's never any mention of things of the heart, heartfelt experiences. Like rights, human rights, and demanding fairness and justice. These are very kind of masculine ideals, in which we, they're very much from the intellect, and so we're very good at that in modern society and West, where we've developed that side of idealism of what's right and what should be, taking thought to its peak of superlatives and then kind of comparing human existence, the realities of our life, with the ideals of how it should be if everything were perfect. And gratitude is a heartfelt experience. Just like love and respect and gratitude, we can't demand these from anybody. As soon as somebody says you should be grateful to your mother and father, we feel a resistance. Or you should respect me. I'm the head monk here, and I made it impossible for you to respect me. Or saying truisms like you should love. You should feel love for people and not hatred. And we all, as an ideal, that is, there's no dissent. But this love is not something that we can command or demand. So we're reflecting today on the experiences of the heart, putting it in this context, the English language. We use the word heart. The mind, the word mind usually refers to the intellect, the rational ability, the ability to think logically and be reasonable. In the Mangala Sutta, one of the greatest blessings, this is the Mada Pidu Bhatanang, tending to mother and father, cherishing the family, and having a clear, unperplexed mental activity is considered the highest blessing. So this Mangala Sutta is we talk about the highest, what are blessings when we talk about, when we use this word blessing. And so I've contemplated this a lot. What do I mean when I say it's a blessing, or this is, I have been blessed, or you have been blessed, or we have been blessed? And of course we kind of have a vague idea of what we mean. But the reality of being blessed, are we really aware of being blessed, of blessing as we experience it? Or is it just another kind of abstraction of the mind, another ideal? The more negative we get, the more cynical we become, then we create a situation in our mind where we're not open to blessings, even if we're receiving them. Like really negative ways of thinking, cynicism, seeing, looking on the dark side, on the negative, create mental conditions that we're even in the midst of being blessed, we may not even recognize it. Being cynical, and that has a kind of cleverness, and sometimes we live in a world that we no longer trust in so many ways, in a society that's very confused. We're living at a time where the kind of conventions that gave a sense of stability and certainty in our lives have been kind of blown away. The kind of definitions that say existed 10 years ago or 15 years ago in the Cold War period, where we knew where our enemy lived and it could be easily defined, and that now is gone, isn't it? Where at the enemy, the war on terror, it could be anywhere, isn't it? We have to spend so much time thinking about defending our boundaries, our borders, in order to kind of stop any kind of infiltration, because the enemy can creep in at any point and disrupt our lives even more. And yet at the same time, we've never experienced a more kind of comfortable and abundant material life. So the world around us is in so many ways especially in the Western world, which include especially Western Europe, the United States, and countries like Australia, New Zealand, Japan. These kind of affluent countries give a sense of you know, we have the democratic systems, we have the affluent economies, and we have the best that say in so many ways that human individuals can expect, and yet the amount of discontent. Sense of not being grateful, of the complaining mind, of the bitterness or the cynicism is rampant within countries like this. The Buddhist perspective is the Buddhist teaching is one of reflecting. It's the ability to open to the experience of life, not through ideas and programs and such that we compare experience with, but beginning to open to the reality of being a human being, being a sensitive form, being conscious. The most obvious realities that we're with all the time, but yet probably least understand. Within the affluent world that we live in, the affluent society, still we feel it's a tremendous lack, something missing, something incomplete in our lives. No matter how wealthy or well-run or that the country might be, there's something still missing. This sense of incompleteness is the ghost that haunts the human heart. And of course the Buddha addressed this in his very direct teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the dukkha or the suffering that is the common experience of all human beings everywhere, whether it's in poor countries or affluent countries, men, women, young, old, rich, poor, whatever. their position might be, the reality of suffering is very much the same thing. If you're poor, you can blame it on the rich. And you think, if I were wealthy, then I wouldn't suffer. But even then, we began to recognize that the wealthy suffer. The most fortunate, seemingly most fortunate people seem to suffer sometimes even more than the poorer ones. Where are the highest suicide rates? In what countries are usually the wealthiest, the most well-run, the most secure in the ways of the political system or the economy? Because I think as we have this sense of this security is fulfilled in so many ways around us in the society, it leaves us with nothing but either we just dwell on the things we don't like and endlessly kind of bring up into consciousness the complaints and the whinging, nagging complaints about this and that, or we tend to see no purpose to life, no point to it, and therefore the will to live, it seems like, you know, some people feel it's better just to end it. Or sometimes, like many of us, have the very opportunities afforded us a chance to explore other ways of looking at life, such as the West's sudden interest in Buddha Dhamma, in meditation, in yoga, in holistic ways of looking at life, holistic attitudes. Now the Western world is very much one based on ideals and on the ideal of individualism, being asserting your rights as an individual. And this individualism, of course, is a very attractive ideal, but it also, the dark side of individualism is that it tends to separate us. If we're highly individualistic, we find it very difficult to include in our lives. We tend to feel very separate from our parents, from even our partners, our wife, husband, children, society. The more individual the more kind of separate you make yourself, the sense of me and mine becomes stronger, then the feeling of separation increases. So I found in my own life, coming from this kind of background, a sense of incredible loneliness and an inability to really feel connected with other human beings, including my parents and friends and friends, close friends, intimate friends, because the attitude was one that tended to separate, that created this illusion of separation. In the joining the Buddhist Sangha in Thailand, then this gave me the opportunity to investigate this haunting loneliness and sense of isolation, which I really couldn't blame, you know, I couldn't blame it on anybody. It wasn't because people rebuffed me or ostracized me or persecuted me in any way. I had no real easy scapegoats to blame it on. And so it became very much apparent that it was a whole way of thinking, of looking at life, of looking at experience that I had developed and which had never been challenged, never been reflected upon in any way, but merely reinforced through the experience of life. In a Buddhist monastery, and living in a traditional Thai forest monastery. So I moved from, say, the more kind of modern New Age lifestyle of California into a very conservative Buddhist monastery in northeast Thailand. And because in those days, the Northeast was very much kind of, you know, it wasn't very developed materially. It was considered the poorest, least attractive part of Thailand. But it was famous for having, producing very good monks. So many of the great Buddhist monks, the Thai people tend to uphold and respect, most of them actually come from Northeast Thailand. And I can understand that, because in the mentality of those people, there were strong family bonds, an old rice growing culture. It was still very unmodern. There wasn't electricity where we lived. There, people used water buffaloes to plow the fields, and everything was like, you know, could be at a totally different age. And now it's changed. Thailand has become very modern. But I was able to live in the monastery at a time when it was changing from the old way to a more modern one, where the values change and the sense of democracy, individual rights, opportunities for expression, self-expression, for getting what you want, living your own life, became more conscious and more available to people in Northeast Thailand. Gratitude, I found, is as a reality, even though I understood the word, and certainly felt I was grateful in terms of, I could kind of think about it and then say I'm very grateful for this and that, and when I was in a positive mood, and yet the mind was very much conditioned to be critical and negative. To be critical of the country I'm from, be critical of the parents, critical of the society. And of course, when I entered the monastic life in Northeast Thailand, then that critical mind was very, was still active. It didn't stop just because I moved away from the United States. But it would find ways of operating within the monastic system. But in monastic life, there is an emphasis on what they call samana sanya, which is reflecting on the life of the alms mendicant, on the samana, the life of living the life of the brahmacharya, the life of the monk and nun. And of course, this was, I found, very helpful to me, because it gave me a way of looking at my own discontent, the sense of my lack, the complaining attitudes of the mind. It gave me a perspective I'd never really had before, was never encouraged before in any other form. So the monastic life is, the ideal of the bhikkhu that developed from India 2,500 years ago was the life, brahmacharya life, celibacy, and alms mendicancy. And to a Western mind, this sounds like a kind of denial of life, to many people, when I became a bhikkhu, they would accuse me of denying life, of running away, of trying to suppress, of seeing life in a very negative way, something I had to resist and fight against, to control, because celibacy to the Western mind, I think, is probably one of the most offensive sexual attitudes there is in the world. They manage to accept every other form of sexuality, but celibacy seems to really bring up a lot of anger. Because it sounds to a Western conditioned mind like denial of the procreative impulse, the natural tendencies reproduction, a denial of the beauty and joy of sexual relationship and so forth. So that this to the Westerner, the relinquishment of active sexuality seems like almost a perversion. But the monastic form is based on reflection, on this samanasanya. And so, like Ajahn Chah used to say, the Buddha was just trying to simplify life. You know, if you're an alms mendicant, if you're depending on alms, then you can't, how could you support a wife and family? You know, that would be being irresponsible in the Asian context of just having a family or procreating the species and depending on the charity, on alms. So celibacy then is the kind of agreement to be able to live as a mendicant and not be create a burden and be a nuisance or a problem to the society that you're living in. Also, the people can see alms mendicancy as a kind of degrading way to live. You know, from my background, the idea of being independent and self-sufficient was the ideal. The individual, to be independent, not to depend on anybody, to be self-sufficient. I can take care of myself, I don't need you, because I can look after myself, this kind of assertion of my will and my independence and that I don't need anybody was highly praised and regarded in America. And that sounds very inspiring, actually, to me when I was young. This was what I wanted. You know, I didn't want to be somebody dependent on somebody else, and I'd have been assertive and independent, living my own life, following my own intuition, living life in my own way. All these kind of ideals were very attractive to me. But the result, say, by the age of 30, was an increasing sense of separation, loneliness, feeling of being cut off, inability to include others in my life, because there is so much commitment to asserting myself and my own rights. Now, with the whole point of meditation, then it's training oneself in a totally different way. It's not idealistic. Meditation doesn't come from trying to live up to ideals or trying to become anything. But first of all, when I became a bhikkhu, a Buddhist monk, then there were the ideals of what a good bhikkhu should be. And of course, I tended to interpret this in a very Western way, trying to make myself, to kind of will myself into the role model of the good monk. And then, by repressing my own feelings and trying to act, put on the, I had the robe, shaven head, the appearance, and then try to act the role of the Buddhist monk. I was quite successful at this in the beginning. I'm quite a good actor. I'm basically a good enough person, so I mean, it wasn't that much of a strain, but also it left something, there was still some lack. No matter how good a monk I tried to be, still there was something missing. There was something, you know, this loneliness was just increasing. And then, as I've told you many times before, in the sixth year of my monastic life, I had a kind of overwhelming gratitude experience. Now, insight is like that. You know, we talk about having insight into the Dhamma or the truth. And we can, in many ways, understand Dhamma intellectually. You know, we can read the scriptures and all the necessary commentaries and study Sanskrit and Pali and Chinese and learn all about Buddhism, be authorities, write papers, and still not have any real insight into it. Because the intellect is something that is very limited. It's a dualistic function that we have. Thinking itself, language and thought. Thought depends on language. And this is a conditioning, a condition factor in the mind that we become very attached to and very much identified with. So even though we might know everything about Buddhism, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, and visit all the great teachers and learn all the ancient languages, if we haven't had a real insight into it, then it remains still a kind of surface understanding. We might admire it, think it's, you know, we might feel it's, we also can be critical of it. Our critical minds get very busy looking at the problems of modern Buddhist countries. We can easily criticize. We go to Thailand or Sri Lanka or other Buddhist places, and there's plenty to criticize. What we don't like about this and what's wrong with that, according to our own values and the way we think, because the intellect is very good at seeing how things should be and what's wrong with the way it is. So this critical mind is dependent on thought itself. As long as we're bound in and limited by our own thoughts, we're bound into that world of birth and death. We're limited by our own thought patterns. And so we see the world in a very limited and narrow way. And that we can expand, we can become more friendly, develop good manners, polite behavior, do charity work, all kinds of good acts in the world. But if it's still based on ideas and thought and on the intellect, then it's still something missing. There's a lack. There's something incomplete. The best thoughts, still there's something lacking. When we try to create the society to fit the patterns of our ideals, what happens is we tend to, you know, we can be very insensitive to the needs of the people we're with, the countries we're in, because we know how it should be and we try to make it so, oftentimes using draconian means, unskillful methods, tyrannical methods to create a fair and just society. As we all aware of, you know, that just by, you know, trying to force communism on everybody, it ended up as a form of tyranny. even though communism as an ideal certainly is, you know, superlative. What can be, that's the taking the material world and really making it into totally fair experience, equality for everybody, no rich, no poor, everybody the same, and working for the welfare of the society, all the best ideals. And then try, and I don't think anybody really objects, that can be quite inspiring. In fact, in the early part of the previous century, there were many, many Westerners, Americans, British, Europeans, fascinated with communism because Marxism and communism were idealistic, they were inspiring to us, and we could feel, this is something worth working for, something to commit to, something really good. And yet the means was one of tyranny, of imposing, of forcing our ideals onto you. And so if I go around kind of forcing my ideals upon you, when you're not, I'm just coming at you and telling you and taking away all your money and telling you, you've got to share it with all the poor, I may be right in a way, but I'm also being a tyrant. I'm tyrannizing you. And so my action is one of tyranny, but yet my ideal is sublime. So we get very confused, what's wrong with idealism? Where does it go astray? Why do idealistic people oftentimes compromise and end up being, corrupted? Why is that possible? Why can't we be loyal and firm in our ideals and committed to our ideals as we would like to be, as another ideal? Now in the monastic form, if I tried to live it as an ideal, then I could only live it for a short time. I would not be a monk now if I was just operating from that level alone, because one can only make oneself into a good example and a kind of role model on that ideal level for a time, and then you can't do it anymore. Because your will, you take your will to a point and then it stops. You can't make it get beyond that point. You become disillusioned, embittered, critical, resentful, and have to leave, have to do something else. But the whole point of being a Buddhist samana was in meditation. I didn't need any more high-minded ideas. I was filled with those, had enough of that. But I just needed something very practical, something, that would allow me to understand things in a way that I couldn't understand just through intellectually knowing about them. And so this was this sense of intuition, this ability to reflect, begin to wake up and notice, to look at this sense of lack, of something missing, not as a way of analyzing, is something wrong with me or my parents or the society or the religion or whatever, but in actually not trying to put the blame or find the cause as something caused by something outside myself, or to just blame myself as some inadequate person who's somehow not what he should be. That was the other extreme. But to begin to recognize, in that very recognition, in that noting and observing ability, then insight happens to us. So the way of mindfulness, this awareness, then is that which is missing in us. If we're just living according to ideas, then there is a tremendous lag. The most important factor is missing. It's not that we don't have it, we don't recognize it, we don't value it, we don't even know about it. So we're always looking for something, looking for fulfillment in a relationship with somebody else, or in a profession, or in an organization, or trying to find something that will fill this lack by searching outwardly. Or just trying to improve myself personally, go on personal improvement courses, you know, to try to make myself more kind of open, more sensitive, more holistic, more in tune, more compassionate, more loving, and all this as on a personal level. It's still, the lack is still there. Because the lack is a real lack, it's not an imagined one. And it's that willingness to observe that emptiness, that lack, rather than just try to ignore it or bypass it. So much, it seems like so many human endeavors are just a frantic attempt to ignore that. That the fear of being alone, of the silence, of stillness, and that we want to create noise and sound and activity and excitement and romance, adventures, busyness. All this is just this frantic attempt to fill this silence, this lack, this space, with something, you know, whatever. Anything will do sometimes. So in the monastery, of course, it is, basically a limited lifestyle. You're put in limitations you ordinarily wouldn't have on behavior. And you're living in a smaller framework of convention. It's narrower. So that this can be seen as a kind of oppressive experience, suffocating us, and for a while that's how it feels. But the aim of it is not to smother or to deny ourselves, but to make available, to help create an opportunity for insight into the Dhamma, or ultimate truths, or reality. Because all the other things, all the ideas, the thoughts, and that, they're artifices that we create. And so coming from the culture that I'm from, the cultural conditioning, idealistic, it's very, it's very, you know, educated, informed, had all kinds of privileges and freedoms, and yet there was no attempt to awaken me to reality. It was merely a conditioning of the mind to know about things, to have ideas, to have opinions and views. So in this monastery, first monastery in Ubon Ratchathani, northeast Thailand, most unlikely place to ever live. I never ever heard of Ubon Ratchathani before. I found myself living there. But the aim of the life was to awaken. And so the life was very simple, basically. It was quite, on the material level, very primitive. There were no luxuries in those days, none at all. And in fact, the Ajahn Chah used to, I think, really try to make life more difficult for us in some ways, so that we like food, for example, he was very keen on making the food totally unedible. they used to mix up all the food in these big basins, enameled basins, and the village people would come with nice little prepared things with fish and chicken and rice and vegetables, and they'd pour it all in this big thing and mix it up. And so you, and then they'd ladle it out. So we eat from the alms bowl and you kind of feel like some kind of animal in a farm, you know, being fed. I found it quite repulsive, but you know, the food. And I've never been able to do that. Ajahn Chah is the only monk I've known that could get away with such an outrageous thing. In the monasteries, no monasteries I know of that do that anymore. But this shows the power of a great teacher. I mean, we would go along with it because of our faith in him. And it didn't put me off. In fact, I stayed, you know, I lived there 4 years in that particular place. You know, it wasn't, you know, I just learned to adapt to it. It was more important to stay there than to follow my desire for good food. But I noticed when I went to other monasteries where they had good food, I went a bit, I'd lose it a bit. There was a monastery I visited in Chonburi. It was a very wealthy area near the Gulf of Thailand, and they're very wealthy. So you'd go on the alms round in the morning, and the quite wealthy people would be putting really nice, delicious Thai food in your alms bowl. And I mean, it's really just watching my mind, you know, being stimulated by all this delicious food. But what I did benefit from is this reflection, because in monastic life, you're not looking at monasticism as it should be. You know, the ideal of the Buddhist monk and the great teachers and an ideal Buddhist monastery. You're not trying to create an ideal Buddhist monastery, in other words. Now, the Western mind, when I went to help establish the Wat Banana Chat, when I first started that, I was still operating from ideals of wanting to create an ideal monastery there. And it didn't take me long to figure out that it wasn't possible. But I mean, the cultural conditioning was one, still one of wanting to make, you know, figuring out what the best monastery would be like, how it should be, and then create it. But Ajahn Chah didn't operate like that, and then there was much more practical, such as we reflect on the four requisites, the alms food, the robes, the shelter, medicine for illness. These basic requisites that the Buddha allowed in the tradition, in the ancient tradition for alms mendicancy, they were a kind of basis for reflection. So we reflect that at least we have food, we have shelter for the night, we have adequate robes to wear, something to cover the body, and medical medicine for sickness. So those were the requisites for monastic, for the alms mendicant. Then the teaching, like with Ajahn Chah, the Dhamma Vinaya is very strict in the discipline, in the traditional monastic discipline of Vinaya. So this was at first quite seemed a very complicated additive to life, with so many rules and major rules, minor rules, and different attitudes, how many, what's your intention, it all seemed incredibly complicated and convoluted to me in the beginning. And yet, according to the scripture, the Buddha said, I leave you the Dhamma and the Vinaya. So in terms of the perfect monastery, I began to see Wat Pa Pong, or Ajahn Chah's monastery, as shelter. I had food, even though it was was all mixed up together, not very tasty. I had adequate robes, I had medicine, Dhamma Vinaya. So the essentials were there. So that, recognizing that, then I had a way of reflecting on my own way of wanting better food, wanting better robes, wanting a better kuti to live in. First they gave me a kuti I didn't like. A kuti is a little hut that you live in. And they gave me a kuti that was much, you know, too, the ceiling was too low. I kept hitting my head on the beams. And so I kept saying, I needed a taller kuti. But they didn't build tall things at Wat Bapong till I came. The following year they built taller kutis. But because I was the tallest monk, it was never a consideration before. But it was a shelter for the night. So even though my personality, my cultural conditioning was complaining about this kuti, this hut, and yet I could reflect on the fact that it would prevent the rain from drenching me in the night. It was adequate as a shelter. And so I began to, just use this way of reflecting, just to observe the complaining mind, the mind that could think of improving, making it better, getting a better place, a taller kuti, better food, making life, it was conditioned for this, for trying to improve and make things better all the time. But that really wasn't what I joined the monastic life for. It wasn't to increase the material comfort and get my own way, but to be able to have a convention that would reflect this tendency, this habit of the mind toward always looking at what was wrong, what I didn't like, thinking of how much better it should be. I could always think of so many ways of improving everything, making the system better, improving the vinaya, improving the monastery, improving the food, making the kutis better. I mean, my mind naturally gravitates into those ways of thinking. So the gratitude took me about 6 years, really, because even though I wanted to be grateful, it was still an intellectual ideal, but the actual experience or insight, the opening of the heart, the sense of real gratitude, or katanyu, gatavaiti in Pali, this katanyu arose after my sixth vasa, when I was in India, and I began to reflect on, the goodness of my life, how much had been extended to me. I began to feel gratitude to my parents in a way that I never, ever had felt before. Gratitude to my own country, to America. Gratitude for all the good things, the supportive things, the kind things, the generosity that had been extended to me in so many ways through my life, not just at the monastery, but throughout my life. Where before that, I was much more aware of what was wrong, the lack, that it should have been like this, they shouldn't have done that. I was much more aware of what was wrong with the United States, what was wrong with my parents, what was wrong with the monastery. That was how the mind was conditioned to think and to regard these and become obsessed with these criticisms. Now the result of Gadanyu was like something opened up from getting out of this brain which was developed already into, you know, very dualistic ways of looking at things, into a more, what you, in English, a heartfelt relationship to life. Which I never really experienced before, to tell the truth. Probably as a child, I remember as a young child, before I was highly programmed by the society, there was a kind of spontaneity and joy in life. But then as the cultural conditioning began to have its effect, the competitiveness and the education increased and the idealism, then of course this disappeared. And one was always comparing oneself with others in terms of, you know, usually in a comparison you're always looking at them and I'm better or worse than you. So in this Gadanya Yogatavaita experience was like from that time on my meditative life began to really develop. Where before it was very much an act of will, you know, me practicing, me getting my concentration, me getting my samadhi, me practicing, me doing the work, and there's all this sense of me and mine and willfulness was a strong factor and the motivating factor in monastic life in the early years. But that will, it you can't sustain it, you know, you can, it doesn't, after a while, it's dry, it doesn't nurture, it doesn't nourish you at all. No matter how successful you might be at willful acts and getting your own way and getting what you want, there's still a lack there, something missing, you know, even if you're successful. And which I wasn't always successful. I mean, I certainly had a strong will. I could discipline myself, and I could make myself do things, and I was quite good at ascetic practices. I could fast and make my life totally miserable physically, and get quite high on it because of the kind of sense of exhilaration in being able to do something and prove something and get something. But whatever I got, no matter what height I achieved, it was not a sustainable state. As soon as the conditions changed, it fell flat again. There I was, nowhere. Just memories, and thinking, I have to go through all that again. You know, I have to not sleep, not eat. Is that how it's just keep doing that, repeating that to get that kind of high experience? And after a while, you don't want to do it anymore. You've had enough. It's no longer attractive. But then the Gadanya Gatavaiti, the gratitude. Because it was, I see it as what I call a heart opening. Suddenly, this heart chakra, as they say, or this place here, I began to operate more from the heart, and which is not a rational place. You know, it isn't a critical mind that's deciding what this is worth and who's right and who's wrong. It's much more where gratitude starts manifesting. Isn't your heart particularly saying that you have to be worthy and everything has to be, your parents have to be perfect for you to feel grateful, or that your country or your monastery or your teacher or the people you're living with have to be really, on the ball and really, be worthy of my gratitude, because that is not possible. And that it's like, it's a very conceited kind of attitude that my for me to feel grateful. I can only feel grateful for having the very best. But Gatanya isn't a matter of having the best, but in reflecting on the kindness and goodness of others, the opportunities, no matter how small or insignificant they might seem, just a kind word or a kind act or something caring and generous, spontaneous. These memories of these events started arising in consciousness. I started thinking, started through reflecting on my life with Ajahn Chah, of course, which I felt enormous gratitude for, because it was a life-saving experience. Going to stay with Dungpo Cha was like, it actually saved my life, I swear. I don't think I'd be alive now if it was. But it was like the receiving me, teaching me, the generosity, extended to me through the offering of food, like today, just the way people offered all this food at the mealtime to us. This is a sense of generosity that we can't say, you've got to give us food and you have to feed me. And then when we don't, we have to just take the risk. Maybe nobody will want to feed us. So then spontaneity, because when you can see on Sunday, people come, they put a lot of effort into preparing delicious food and probably spending quite a lot of money, because food is not cheap in this country, and preparing it and offering it to us and it's just by reflecting on this goodness, so that today I've had my nourishment in terms of food that's necessary for survival, and it's been offered in this generous way. By reflecting on that, then this sense of katanyu arises. When I think of my parents who passed away many years ago, but recognizing their kind of moral integrity, their care, their interest in me, and their providing me with the necessary things while as a baby, as a child, as a teenager. I'm just their good intentions, rather than dwelling on the things I didn't particularly like about them. My generation, we were very much, when we went into university, we were all primed by taking psychology 101 in the university mothers in those days were to blame for everything. And now it's fathers, I think. Absentee fathers and things like that are the ones you blame for all your problems. But back in the 50s, it was mothers. They were the ones that were at fault for everything wrong in the world. And even though, I had a very nice mother, actually, but I had to really search for things to be critical, and it wasn't easy. She wasn't kind of an easy person to fault. But a good critical mind can find fault with anyone. So this afternoon, this subject of gratitude to parents, the whole subject of gratitude, respect, love, the word love, you can't say you must love me, and that love comes, it isn't, you can't command it, and respect, and say you've got to respect me because I'm important Buddhist monk, I'm senior, And you have to respect me because I'm somebody important. That means that made it impossible for you to respect me. Because that's not respectful, is it? You can't respect someone that demands respect. Because these are heartfelt responses to life. Love, respect, gratitude. They're responses, they're not reactions. And so in through awareness, through understanding, through opening to life, then it allows these heartfelt experiences to reach consciousness. And this what gives, that fills the lack. If our life is without love and respect and gratitude, then there is an immense lack of something. Life becomes dreary, dull, meaningless, pointless. And we just kind of can drag our way through it some way or another, or just take to drink, drugs or something, or just try to distract ourselves with the modern technology, live in virtual reality, which is possible now, isn't it? We can live in totally artificial world of technology. But how many times can you distract yourself, and at the end of the day, there is this loneliness, this isolation, this sense of lack. And that, of course, disappears when we begin to awaken. And that is the essence of the Buddhist teaching. Awakenness. Because when we begin to recognize, realize, and value this simple ability we all have, then the habits that we've acquired, we have a way of seeing them in perspective, of letting go of them. We're no longer limited and bound into just negative mental state. Or reactions to life. The bad habits we do have, we've acquired already, we learn from. We learn how to recognize them and release ourselves from being taken over, being obsessed with those negative mental states. And when we free ourselves from those delusions, then of course the reality of human consciousness within the human form is one of joy, love, compassion. These are natural responses to experience in the world that we're living in. Gratitude, for me, was as I said before, was a heart-opening experience. After that, I found concentrating the mind, the whole kind of meditative process really took off from that moment, because the heart was then involved in it. It wasn't just a willful ideal from the intellect. It wasn't a me as this limited self trying to make myself into something else. The joy of the life of the monastic. I could really enjoy the life because the life itself is simple. It has its beauty, and one has a lot of gratitude and appreciation for the generosity, the help, the respect that one receives by living this life. And this, of course, leads to encouraging us to continue and to really develop this path till it's complete, till the all the delusions that subtle that might still be lingering around our consciousness began to fade away, and there is a clarity, a purity of conscious reality that we know and we experience. So I offer this as a reflection.